Ryan, welcome to A Runner's Life podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on, Marcus. I'm looking forward to this.
And likewise, I came across your profile from something that our mutual friend, Peter Bromker, shared on his profile after running the Boston Marathon. So I'm really interested to take a deep dive into what prompted me. But before we get into that, the question I always ask my guests is, what does A Runner's Life mean to you?
Oh, so much. I think the most important thing it means to me, though, is it's a way for me to better understand and navigate this world that has been harder and more challenging for me to navigate. Running brings me peace. It brings me freedom, brings me joy. It's a quiet place where I can be free from anxiety. And I've always described it to others as it's kind of like self-medicating for my anxiety and for my autism. And it's my me time. I really do feel like I run for my life sometimes. So that's applicable to your podcast for sure.
And thank you for sharing that and, you know, talking a little bit about autism and just the anxiety side. I think it's really cool to talk about those topics and be open about it. I just really want to explore a little bit more of what you said. You know, it's a place to be yourself, a place to be free. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah. So ever since I was young, me and my family discovered that joint compressions would bring me peace, would calm me down when I would be all tense through fear or panic or, you know, sensory overwhelm, the typical things that you would think of when you hear the word anxiety. And what is running, if not repeated joint compressions? It's rhythmic, it's known, it's simple, and you're just able to go out there and do poetry in motion. And I really feel at my deepest peace when I run. I feel closest to God when I run. It's that time where I'm able to completely free myself from, you know, from the troubles that I think the majority of people experience in life, right? And it's the escape, and it's the way to create sanity in life that doesn't always make sense.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying it's through the movement which allows you to express all the kind of feelings that you're processing and allows it to kind of be smoothed out.
It's through the movement. I love that. Yeah, exactly. It's through the movement that allows everything to, you know, fall off the back. Or if you picture, like, I personally love running in the rain. It's one of my favorite things to do, especially after a hard day, right? The rain just washes all of that gunk off you, and it's through the movement that it just kind of feels like it cleanses you, you know?
I'm going to challenge you on that one about the running in the rain, though, because we both ran Boston this year and it rained.
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It couldn't have been better weather for me. I was like, I feel so badass right now.
Man, like, I've run two Bostons and every time I run it, it's rained. So I feel like, hopefully the third time, it's not going to rain.
My last Boston was 2019 and it was really stormy, like up until about an hour before the gun. And then like the sun came out and it got humid. So the 2023 Boston was far better in my opinion.
Yeah. But I mean, all jokes aside though, about the kind of running through the rain, and I can picture like David Goggins now just running through the rain.
not the image I was particularly going for, but yes, I see what you're saying.
You've got like a videographer following you going, a lot of people ask me, you're like, okay.
Oh, that would be sweet. Do you know one?
Oh, no. But all jokes aside, just going back to the point as well, because I'm also neurodiverse. So, you know, for me, running is a way to, again, self-regulate. So you know, when I heard you say that, it kind of made me feel like that's the kind of similar type of thing.
Yeah, it's the exact same type of thing. You say regulate, I think I said medicate, the same type of deal. It keeps you even, right? It keeps the roller coaster from getting too high or too low. And yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying.
I think this is probably also typical to neurotypical people as well, that they probably run to, you know, self-regulate as well. So I think hopefully we're not excluding those people. But obviously, I think from our side, I think just what's happening inside your mind, you just need sometimes an outlet to get all that kind of that emotion out.
Yeah, absolutely. Get the jitters out, right? And like you were saying, I'm sure neurotypical people, like, same thing. We all have stuff we're going through, and I think running helps everyone manage stress levels and, you know, have the ability to cope better with life.
Yeah, I agree. So I really want to talk about Boston, but before we dive into that, a question I've been thinking about more recently is just like, is the running watch and what data fields people have in the running watches. And I feel like I've got too much. I've basically
so much.
I've got time. I've got average pace, current pace, average heart rate. And I was looking at a couple of people's, like, some of our other teammates on Relay, and it's funny. Like, you could tell who the pro racers are, and I was just like, maybe I'm I've got too much data. So jokes aside, I really want to know, what data fields did you have on your running watch when you're running Boston?
Let me pull up my watch so I make sure I get this answer correct.
That's right.
Let's see. I had pace in the top, and then distance, cadence, and time. Because I wanted to make sure I was keeping popping off the ground pretty good with the cadence. Obviously, distance, pace, and time would be important. But I didn't have any of that data for the first 17 miles because my watch didn't load. So I know we're not quite at Boston yet, but I had my watch loaded all the way, and I was trying to move up through Corral 2 to get better placement. And I must have bumped somebody, or somebody accidentally bumped me. So when I go to, you know, start my watch, as we're going over the timing mats, I look down and it's in regular mode. And it was, I mean, you were there, it was cloudy, and it would take a while to catch the satellite again. So for the first 17 miles of Boston, my watch said I was running 8:35 per mile pace, which was obviously inaccurate. And it finally caught up to me somewhere in Newton. And then when we finished the Boston Marathon, it said something like, completed 22 miles at 6:40 pace, or something close to that effect. So not super accurate data for this one, but those were the fields I had on my watch, if they would have worked.
If I'm getting this right, so it didn't kick in properly until like the mile 17. So you didn't even know, did it sort of show you kind of like the time that you'd started from?
Yeah, so I mean, I still started my watch, but the pace and the distance was all skewed. So each mile marker along the course, I would split the watch. So at each mile marker, I knew what pace I was running, but in between the markers, complete guesswork. And so I was in a little bit of like freak out, stay calm, try to stay calm for the first 5 miles until I found a good pack that was running pretty consistently.
So basically, you had to do lap splits every like mile or so, or kilometer, however you work it, and then
I had to lap it.
Yeah, and I guess also and you're probably saying for you as well, you know where you need to be, say a mile 20 at a certain point, or halfway, you know what time you need to be at. You can do the quick maths from looking at the clock watch as well on the course.
Right. Yeah, I knew I wanted to be at least for the first 15 miles, like in that 5:35, 5:33 range. Yeah. So like there was huge waves of relief each time I hit a mile marker. It was like, okay, I didn't screw that mile up. Like, let's get to the next one. But yeah.
I think that's really interesting to hear that. It just sort of goes to show that could have potentially derailed your race, but you just kind of went into kind of like, okay, I'm here now, I've got a race, let's just go, trust myself. No, and then it'll figure out.
Yeah, I mean, 16 weeks went into it. I wasn't going to go sit on the curb, but I was definitely like, oh, shoot, this is not the way I wanted to start Boston. Yeah.
I could imagine. Just think, oh, do you know what, guys? Was there a DNF? Oh, well, the watch wasn't working. It's like, there's no way that is happening. You're just like, I'm
No, it's such a lame excuse.
That is the worst excuse ever, to be honest. I'd rather just say, like, my toe hurt than say that to a list.
Oh yeah, anything would be better than that.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about your training. Can you share what was the workout or the workouts that acted as the kind of the find out where I am session, like that you sort of think
involved in? If I recall, there were two big sessions that started to really give me confidence, and this build for the entirety of the build, all 16 weeks, there was one day that I didn't train. It was by far the most mature build I've ever had. I'm a relatively injury-prone runner, so this to have that long stretch of health was huge and have that consistency to stack up. We get 1 month out, and I did a half marathon race in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is relatively hilly, especially the first 6 or 7 miles. So it mimicked Boston, and I felt like it was a good preparation race for Boston from that angle. And I was talking with my coach, and he was like, if you hit 72 or just under 72 minutes for this tune-up half, you know, on those marathon training legs that are probably, you know, still holding some fatigue, then you're in a really good spot. And I hit 70 minutes in 2 seconds, and I felt controlled and smooth and composed the entire way. So that was a huge confidence booster. Because it hadn't been a great weekend leading up to that. I was pretty stressed out with some other things in my life at that time. Yeah, so that was a month out. And then 3 weeks out, I'm pretty sure I got that right. Maybe the race was flipped and the workout was first and the race was 3 weeks out. Oh, yeah, my apologies. The workout was first. The race was 3 weeks out. So the half marathon race I just described was 3 weeks out from Boston. And my biggest long run key session was 4 weeks out. And that was 22 miles. And then I tacked on a mile and a half cool down at the end. So 23 and a half for the day. I did 4 easy, 12 at marathon race pace. And that I was having stomach issues for the first half of this run. So I was pressing through some pretty dark miles in the middle there. Started barely being able to hit marathon pace. And then after a very, very needed porta pot stop, I started feeling better around mile 12 or 13. And marathon pace kind of increased down to 520, 525-ish range. And I was like feeling pretty good there. Then we did a mile easy and 7 by 1 minute at 3K pace, 2 minute float. And then jogged it in for the rest. I think there was about a mile remaining at the end of that fartlek. The fartlek started around 18 or 19 miles, if I remember correctly. So those two sessions were key in like getting the confidence up, because that last long run session was 2 hours and 11. Yeah, 2:10, 2:11 on the feet. And then I did the cool down, which added a little bit more to that time. So I got very close to, you know, time on the feet that I would be for the race at Boston itself.
You know, we're not reinventing the wheel here, but I think it's really interesting what you're saying there. So the two workouts that you're talking about is one is like a hill session, basically working at the marathon pace effort for the half. And the second one is adding the speed work at, you know, varying speeds towards the end of the run when you know you're going to be tired. So you know you've got that extra kick.
Yeah. I thought it was really smart of my coach to throw in like, okay, we're going to do some legit quicker stuff, right? 3K pace is pretty snappy. You know, at mile 19 of this long run, after tiring the legs out for, you know, 12 or so miles at marathon pace with 4 easy before that, it was just really smartly programmed, I thought.
Yeah.
And obviously it did its duty. So.
Absolutely. And something you said, actually, I thought was quite interesting, and you don't have to share the details of the actual circumstance. We talked about for that half marathon, there was a bit of like life stress leading up to the race. So when you got to race day, how do you compartmentalize that? How did you kind of park that and still be able to show up? And, you know, you executed, I mean, a couple of minutes quicker than your planned time.
Yeah, it was a big PR for me, and excellent question. So my mom, actually, she's a writer and just really gifted with words. She texted me the morning of the race and said, "May all of this either fuel you or fall off you as you run." And I just thought that was beautifully written. And that was kind of the mantra, so to speak, going into the race, the mantra or the prayer, like, may this fuel and fall off. And, you know, just run for joy, because that's what I love to do. And it obviously worked very well. And I knew I was there. I knew I was deep in the middle of the best marathon build that I've ever been in. And I was like, well, I mean, we're going to go out there and race as hard as we can. And I ended up not needing to race quite as hard as I could, because I felt controlled the whole way. And I'd never run a successful half up to this point. So like when the racing started getting more you know, okay, this guy's making a move. I let myself hold back just a little bit. I knew I was on pace to get the job done and get the intention done for the day. Mm-hmm. And I probably could have gone with him, but I also wanted, like, I don't know if I'm going to blow up at mile 11 if I go with this guy, because I'm inexperienced in this race distance. And ended up, I felt confident with the decisions I made during the race, and yeah, was able to run that stress away as running has normally been able to do that for me, regardless of what I'm going through.
I think that's a really cool mantra, actually. Let it fuel you or let it fall off you.
Yeah, I do too. I do too.
Because I can imagine, actually, during different moments of that race, it can do both, really. It's not one or the other.
Yeah, yeah. They went hand in hand, and that's why I loved it so much. Like, whenever I was, like, starting to second guess myself, or gosh, do I have this? And I was like, fuel and fall off, fuel and fall off. You got this. And turns out I did.
Do you know what? I'm going to use that in the future. And jokes aside, if your mum, you know, is in the space for, like, giving mantras, I might need to tap into that in the future.
Absolutely. Yes, please use it. Anyone who's listening to this, you got a new mantra there. So
brilliant. So talking of mantras, did you use that same mantra for Boston, or did you use any other mantras?
In Boston, I had two main mantras. The first one, I have to give credit to Des Linden for. I was listening to a podcast of hers, like, talking, or no, it was the Alley on the Run show when Des was on that podcast talking about her past Boston experiences. And she mentioned her mantra, calm, 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 relax, relax, relax. And I used that one significantly in the first 5 miles when my watch wasn't working. It's like, calm, 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 relax, relax, relax. And the other mantra I used, that there's this worship song that I love, and it plays off of the song. It's, Lord, your strength in my legs, your breath in my lungs. Like, let it be your strength in my legs and your breath in my lungs as I run this race to honor you. Your strength in my legs, your breath in my lungs, over and over again. So those are my two main mantras for Boston, and they both felt good, they felt right, and yeah.
It's really cool that you've got, on one hand, you've got Des's one, but then also you've got one, you've made it personal too, but then also you've got your own one. And even when we talked about, you know, your mantra there, I had something similar, and I'm not taking away from your story, but it's almost half of what you've just said, especially when I was on the Newton Hills. I remember Heartbreak Hill and just feeling not in the best spot at that time, and I remember just saying to myself, like, please pick up your feet. It's something actually I got from Paige Dillon. Actually, she said, like, dear God, please pick up my left foot, pick up my right foot. And I remember having this conversation with myself, you know, to pick up my feet, and, you know what I mean, go, because you've got all that kind of negativity in your head saying, stop, this is hard, you should slow down, da da da, and you're just like, no, just focus on one thing after the other. And I like how you talked about just, like, those two things, because actually it's important, because it goes back to self-regulating and focusing on your body, and I think once you you know, you focus on those two things and you think about your breath, you think, actually, I'm actually doing okay, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, it kind of brings you back into awareness, so, like, you can zoom out for a little bit and then zoom back in, be aware, check in with yourself, okay, things are all right, then zoom out again, like, move in and out as there are so many different stages of a marathon. Yeah.
Saying this, actually, something I just thought about, especially being on the autistic spectrum, do you find that the energy from the crowds helps you, or sometimes you find that it can be, sometimes go the other way? But I guess more so, say, if you're in a tricky spot as opposed to feeling good.
Yeah. Oh, really, really good question. I love that. In Boston, I think it worked perfectly for me, because, as you know, there are sections of the course where the crowds are pretty thin, and you're able to, like, just listen to the footfalls and find that rhythm and the peace. I do a lot of my training solo. So, like, find that rhythm and that peace that feels like, oh, I'm on a normal run. And then if you're ever in a dicey spot and you hit a big crowd surge, you so much as, like, raise a hand a little bit, and, like, the crowd just responds to you instantaneously and just carries you through. And I think both aspects of that worked really well, because I think if I had those loud crowds the entire 26.2 miles, I mean, Wesley in particular would be a prime example of that. That could get pretty overwhelming, especially on the sensory system. But the ability to, oh, we're on a normal run, chill back road, you know, townhouses and whatnot. And, you know, for me, the peaceful rain was falling at that point. So it was perfect. And then we hit a crowd. I was starting to like have my little freak out moment around mile nine, been running quick for a while. And I was like, gosh, can I keep this line for, you know, what would it be at that point doing the math? 17 more miles. And that's when I looked to the crowd and like raised my arms to them and they responded and I was like, okay, yeah, we got this and, you know, ride the wave. Boston is so epic. So I think the mix of lesser crowds to more crowds worked really well in my favor for this Boston marathon.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I can relate to that. I feel that the crowds do help and it does give you energy. And I think it depends on what spot you're in. And the reason why I asked you that question was because, you know, I was crazy enough to do Boston and London 6 days apart.
Oh, yeah. And pure madman level. I love it.
So I found like the energy from the London crowd is kind of reminds me of Boston. Like it gives you so much energy. But I found particularly from, say, mile 21 to the end of the London Marathon, it really discombobulating because not so much the crowd so much. I mean, they were still quite loud, but we had like lots of different like music systems and just all these things. So you'd be going through, you know, you're running, you're having a tough spot, and then you've got like some booming music. Just like, it just throws you off your stride. And then you have to like try to self-regulate to go back into running. And I remember there's one particular section where there's like an underpass and they had these drums. And I don't know why they put it there, because then the drums were being echoed by the underpass and just the surrounding structures. So it felt like every beat was like piercing through your entire being, you know. Yeah. It was just really, it's quite overwhelming.
Not what you need when you're deep in a suffer zone.
Yeah. I mean, it was like mile 24, 25, you know, you're just trying to, you're literally just trying to get to the end. And it's like, please, not now. Yeah. And I don't want people to think I'm being ungrateful for the support, but I just think that sometimes I just don't think people are aware that actually it can be quite disorientating in a way you know, in those particular moments. So that's why I asked you that question to see whether you had something similar in Boston. But I think Boston was different. I don't think Boston was the same as London in that sense. I felt like it was like more manageable. I found even with the crowds and stuff, I didn't feel like I was thrown off my stride as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I remember one of my key long run sessions, I had a good friend of mine on the bike who was crewing me, and I was not feeling good. And normally we take a speaker along, play some fun tunes, you know, that kind of thing when the run is going well. And this one was not. And I was like, Julie, we gotta turn off the speaker. Like, it's too much for my sensory system to handle. Like, I'm already feel a little bit disoriented and deep in suffering right now. And, you know, even though I love this song, like, I can't take more stimulus. And we turned off the speaker and, you know, running picked up and got better a couple miles down the road. So yeah, I completely get that. Excellent question.
And I think it's really important to like know when that's happening. And like you're saying, you can control that at that moment. Just be like, look, and you say it to your friend, like, look, can you help? You turn us off and that's fine. But in a race, it's different because obviously you can't say, hey, everyone, can you just shut up?
Right. Yeah. And the support is amazing. Like, I wouldn't change any of that for the world. But there, I think when you're disoriented and just deep and like, I'm trying to move one foot forward at a time, like, it's all I can do to get there. Any runner knows what that feels like.
Yeah.
When you can put all of your focus on that task and it's not being divided up by other stimuluses, then yeah, that can be helpful.
Yeah. And also, you know, it potentially could be a neurotypical thing, because there's one particular experience where I was doing a race with a friend and it's like a multi-stage race. And, you know, it's like in these multi-stage races, you're chatting, you know, you probably overshare, my friend and I were having a good time. We were chatting away. We weren't being disrespectful or too loud. And we passed one particular couple. And I think the wife was having a really difficult moment. Do you know, sometimes you have a difficult moment, and she turned around to us and said, all I can hear you is you two talking in this whole desert. You just be quiet. And there was a really awkward, like, 10 meters until we passed it there to resume the conversation. But, you know, I think sometimes people, you know, Like, it could be like the smallest things like that, or yeah, the bigger thing. Like, you don't know what's going to throw someone off when you're in that dark moment.
Oh no, I feel like your ability to get very mad at something become like it escalates, right? It could be something as annoying as the guy's back pocket zipper is open. Why is that zipper open? That's so maddening.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So true. So we've spoken a little bit about that, but it would really be cool just to go back to Boston 2023. I know we've spoken a little bit. We dipped in and out of it. We talked about the watch. But can you give us a little bit of a breakdown of the race? I know we've spoken about the watch, but obviously just avoiding that aspect as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did my qualifying race a while back, and I was coming off of some Achilles and plantar fascia issues. I ran a low 240, so that definitely qualified me for Boston, but I was in much better than 240 shape when I was racing the 2023 Boston Marathon. Mm-hmm. So my time qualified me for Corral 2 is where I ended up. And my goal was to break 230, so Corral 1 would have been a more ideal starting location. I think there were around 800 people per Corral, so I got myself to the very front of Corral 2 during that time is probably when my watch got bumped. But I was still in like 800, 850th place when the race began. Mm-hmm. And so it was jam-packed, right? Like, I'm doing all I can not to clip the runner's heels in front of me and, you know, probably getting clipped from the back. It's shoulder to shoulder. It's tight. And there's just this small section of sometimes open road on the right side of the road. And then just off the shoulder, it's kind of muddy and grassy because it had been raining. So I had been trying to use this maybe a foot section on the far right and yell, runner moving up on the right. Like, I'm trying to get out of this mess of bodies. And sometimes I had to push a couple people off to the left, which I felt really bad doing, but I also like, I need to be moving faster than this. So that was the first 2 to 3 miles. And then around that 3-4 mile mark, it started to open up a little bit better. And by mile 5, I'd found a pretty solid pack of 10 or so guys. We'd catch some people, we'd lose some people, you know, the pack would shift to and from, but a pretty good core group of 7 to 10 guys. And we rolled from mile 5 to mile 15 together. And that was a pretty comfortable part of the race, the part of the course in Boston where it's mostly flat, maybe some ebbs and flows. And it was raining at that time, which, you know, served me well. I was like, great, I'm at peace, I'm calm, we're good. And we were clipping off pretty consistently 5:35s. We started lower 5:30s, then hung out in the 5:35 range, and then entering Newton, so mile 16, it's that deep descent. I believe you lose 112 feet during that mile. The pack had kind of backed off a little bit, which makes really good sense in preparation for the Newton Hills. And at this point, I'm like, I'm feeling great. I'm not wasting this massive loss of elevation. So I pull out like a low 5:20 on that mile and just, you know, cook it, use gravity to my advantage. And by the time we hit the first of the 4 Newton Hills, I look behind me and the pack wasn't there. It completely dispersed. So at this point I'm realizing, well, kind of got to get to Boston on my own at this point. So eyes up, chase runners, reel them in, find a ladder, you know, body by body, keep moving forward, keep climbing, keep working with the crowds. Really the only scary moment I had prior to that was around mile 9 when I started to, you know, that voice in the back of your head, like the doubt is creeping in. Can you really hold 5:35s for this much longer? But the crowd helped me through that one. And Newton was fantastic. I honestly didn't feel the hills that much. I felt like I was floating. My legs felt strong. I felt powerful. I mean, I knew I was climbing. I knew my pace slowed, but I had talked to my coach the day before the race, and we were talking over tactics and pacing, in particular for Newton. And we were like, if you can come off heartbreak, having stayed with all of your miles being no slower than 6:15, right? Like if the biggest hill in Boston doesn't slow you down more than a 6:15 mile split, you're doing pretty good. And my slowest split in Newton was a 5:54. So like by the time I crested heartbreak, I was like, this is a really good day. I know it's a good day. I'm still thinking that this could blow up in my face because I'm running so much faster than I ever had for a marathon, and even faster than I had planned for this marathon. In fact, at the 10K mat, I turned to the guy next to me and was like, all of my family and friends are going to freak out when they see this split. It is too hot. It is too quick. And at the halfway point, I had planned out in my race strategy, I was like, any faster than 74.20 for the half split probably is not good. I was 73.38. So like each check in marker that I had designed for myself was too fast. And like it pointed to blowing up, you know, around that 10K to go marker when everyone starts to like, you know, the monkey or the bear jumps on your back and things get harder. But I kept on waiting for it to get harder and I was racing hard, right? It's a marathon, but like my body was being able to respond to everything I was asking of it to do. So I never really hit the wall. And coming off of heartbreak, I was just feeling good. I had expected when planning the race to allow like at least a half a mile to like regain composure and try to accelerate back onto that 5:35, 5:40 pace. And within 200 meters, I looked down at my watch and I was at 5:30 because at this point my watch had caught up to me at the GPS finally loaded in Newton. Yeah, I was like, well, we're going good. And for, you know, for the last 5 miles, once we got through Newton, I got water at every aid station at every stop and just splashed it on my face as a way to like stay engaged, stay composed, stay alert, be reactive. And that, that helped.
You not Gatorade as well, don't you?
Oh yeah, I took water. I didn't want to be that sticky.
Can you imagine if you get it wrong? Just, oh no.
Oh, gosh, there goes the no shower plan before the after party. Yeah, so I did make sure it was water and I never got that wrong, thankfully. And when I hit the, you know, I saw the Sitco sign, I was like, it's happening. It's actually happening. And then I go under, you know, go below the underpass with about a kilometer to go. And this is when like I fully allow myself to realize that this isn't going to tank. And I just start like my arms start driving on full adrenaline. I'm charging up from beneath the underpass and that I was like right onto Hereford. I took the corner super close and was like clipping hands by accident and left on the Boylston. There were runners right up in front, two guys who were maybe 15, 20 meters ahead. And so I charged them down and was just barely able to outkick them at the line. And it was the most incredible running experience I've ever had in my life. Cause I'd visualized that final 600 meters on Boylston several times a day for 16 weeks. And it happened exactly how I visualized it, which doesn't always happen, right? Like as runners who plan these big races, we know that, but this one did. And I saw as a comparator, like just going straight down to the finish line. I saw all of that. But I also kind of saw myself from the stands, being able to point to the crowds, get them hyped. And it was just such an incredible experience. The last really important thing from the Boston race was about 2 miles before finishing, I caught up to Peter Bronkma.
Yeah.
And I had the pleasure of being able to chat with him on Newbury Street for a couple of minutes on Saturday before the race. And he shared advice and I told him how his writing had helped me prep for the course and helped me understand the course better. And I had read everything that he wrote in relation to Boston. So I came up on him about 2 miles to go and he was just like, go on, man, you're having a great day. Go, go, go. And so at the finish line, I waited for him and we got to embrace, you know, hug really tightly, jump up and down, celebrate, shouts of adulation, all of that. I was so choked up and tearing up. And I remember it clearly and also kind of cloudy at the same time because there was just so many things happening. But being able to celebrate with Peter at the line was, I don't know how to say how special that was for me. So very... It was the perfect day, or as close to perfect as you can have when racing a marathon, for sure.
Yeah, there's so many things in there that I want to touch on, but I think just to give a bit of context, and we will go into this slightly later, is you did a lot of research with Peter's writings, and that was really helpful. So that was I could see why that's a meaningful aspect and a part of your Boston experience. Before I go back to that Peter thing, it's really interesting when you talk about just the aspect of racing and pushing and thinking, am I going to blow up or am I not going to blow up? It's almost like, if I can give a really bad analogy.
Oh, please. I love bad analogies.
Boston Marathon is like, do you know when you're cooking a meal for you and a group of friends, right? And you're seasoning it, right? Uh-huh. And you're seasoning it during, and you think, do I put too much salt in now? And I've ruined the dish, or do I underseason it? You know, that's what it feels like before you get to Newton Hills. And then only until then, you know whether you've underseasoned it or you overseasoned it.
I love that analogy. I don't think that's a bad one at all. That fits so well.
And your friends are just like, you know, this is not seasoned. And they put the salt in, and you're like, you're crust either way, or you've overseasoned it. They're like, we're getting a takeout. You know, we're not trusting you with the food again.
If you don't get it right, it's ruined on either side. Yeah.
Exactly. Sorry, that's how my mind works. When I don't know why the food reference came in, to be honest.
We're runners, Marcus. Obviously, everything relates back to food.
Absolutely, yeah. Always thinking about food.
Always.
But, you know, I mean, but it's really cool, though, like you're saying. I think when you have those moments where you're giving your max effort and you're on that line and you're just going slightly deeper, and it's still within that controllable range, and it must be, like you're saying, like a great feeling when it comes off, because as runners we have lots of runs where that we do the same effort but it doesn't work out the same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a feeling like I've never had when running, just being able to everything I asked of my body it could do. And that's the good kind of suffering, right? Like, you're doing it to yourself, you're hurting, you're pushing, and it's awesome. The bad kind of suffering, at least to me, is when you're telling yourself, okay, you gotta go, you gotta press in here, and there's just nothing in the legs. Tank's empty. Like, you can't respond to the request that your brain is giving your body. And that is a really dark place to be as a competitor for me. And Boston was the suffering that I had control over, right? Like, everything I told my legs to do, they could do. Like, they immediately enacted it. And I just rode that high the entire way.
It's that feeling of changing the gears. And when you have that control, when you know you can go up the gears, it's amazing. But when you're trying to upshift and it feels like you're downshifting, you're just like, what is happening here, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You spoke a little bit about Peter as well, and I know you did a little bit of research with his writings, and I think we spoke about the article 9,000 Seconds. Can you talk a little bit about that and any other pieces of writings that he did?
9,000 Seconds.
Yeah.
9,000 Seconds, I think, was the most influential one for me, because that was his first attempt at breaking 2:30, and this was my first attempt at breaking 2.5 hours. And the way he broke it down, he had like about one or two paragraphs on each mile, his thought process, where he was in the course, what the next section would be. He clumped a few miles together, but it really felt like an outline of my race plan. Like, this, we both came from Division III athletics and were getting better as we got older. And I was like, this is the outline of my goal. This, he did it, and now I'm going to try to do it. And then he wrote me the roadmap, and I'm gonna follow the map. So that was really impactful for me, and clearly it worked well.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like there's a lot of prep that went into it, just mentally, physically, from the training as well. And I think having that perspective helps you place yourself in it. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the final bits of advice that Peter gave you on Saturday?
Yeah, Saturday, the thing that stuck with me the most is just like, find a good pack, roll through those first 15 miles. And then when you get to Newton, you're going to know who was bluffing and who wasn't. And in my head, I'm thinking, wow, that's a really long bluff. but he was absolutely right. Like, I talked about when I was recapping the race, when I started that first hill, 17 and 18, mile 17 and 18 of the first couple hills there, I looked back and the pack I'd been working with wasn't there. So I moved on from the pace, or some of them were bluffing, or a combination of the two. But that was the most impactful thing he said to me. He was like, find a good pack, and then you're going to know who's in it for good and who isn't when you get to Newton. And that stuck with me. So, yeah.
And it's funny that when it happens, because in your head, you're thinking, I know you bluffed, you couldn't handle it. But you also don't say it out loud because you're thinking, I don't want karma to slap me in the face.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the entire time I'm thinking I'm bluffing too. It's like the mind games that happen in these long drawn out races. Yeah, for sure.
When you reflect on Boston and your training, this is like two questions in one, but what worked really well in the race and in training? And what do you think you'll do differently the next time round when you run Boston again or you train again for a marathon?
So I did this whole buildup on very low mileage. My peak week was 65 miles. And I think I averaged in the around the 50 mile a week range. Yeah, like 50 low, which for a marathoner, especially someone going in that sub 230 range is, I mean, that's not much. But I knew that I was injury prone and I spent 3 days a week in the gym for 2 hour sessions each time, working on, you know, runner specific force development, plyometrics, heavy lifts, whether it's a working on the explosive quarter squat or a little bit of a deeper squat, the deadlift, the RDLs, some knee over toe stuff for mobility and hip flexor strength, and that posterior chain. And I think the combination of the low mileage and the high volume of lifting worked really well for me. And I definitely think I should continue that. For Chicago, I would like to be able to lower the amount of time I spend in the gym, see if I can kind of dial that in and hit the important stuff in a little less time so that hopefully I can go up in mileage a bit more. I'm taking a trip, not this coming week, but the next week. I'm not sure when this will air, but the week of June 12th, I'm taking a trip to Boulder, Colorado for 1 week to work with Chris Lee and take a deep dive into mechanics and analysis there. And then see if we can dial in that strength component so I can get a little more extra time to log a few more miles and hopefully do so in a safe manner that will keep me healthy. And that is the current plan for Chicago. Right now I'm focusing a bit more on speed, 5K and down. And then once we get into early to mid-July, we'll start to lengthen that out and do a proper marathon build again.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's small changes to what you're doing as opposed to like wholesale changes, especially with the strength work and the work of the mileage. That makes sense. And for running for Chicago, I know you're running for a particular course. You want to talk a little bit about that?
So I am running on a charity team for Chicago, Organization for Autism Research, OAR, which I ran for them in my first marathon back in early 2018, the DC Rock and Roll. And I'm really excited to be able to run for them again. I'm trying to raise money for autism research. And obviously that is a cause that is near and dear to my heart. And if anyone here listening feels so inclined, any small donation, right, everything matters and everything goes to furthering resources for people and kids on the spectrum to be able to get the help they need as early as possible. And the earlier they get the help, the bigger a difference it makes in their lives and their ability to do life and navigate the world well. So I'm super excited to be able to not only race as competitively as I can at Chicago, but to do it for a deeper meaning than just, hey, I did this and put the stat on the paper. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think what's really interesting is when you talk about the support that autistic people, you know, will need or require, because for you, you were diagnosed early in your life. And you're going to tell the story better than I will, but you were pretty much written off early on by some of the medical professionals. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad we're backtracking all the way back there. I was four when I was diagnosed, and the diagnosing doctor informed my parents that he didn't believe I would ever be able to write at all, that my reading level would never exceed the fifth grade level. That being able to pick up on social cues, verbal, nonverbal, et cetera, would be very difficult for me in social and community type settings. And that athletic coordination, the neuromuscular signaling would be very difficult for me. So obviously athletics would be out, and my parents just held steadfast, and they said, no, we refuse to accept this. And I recalled mom teaching. She was very athletic back in the day, into healthy lifestyle and whatnot. And I remember her spending literally a week's time trying to help me understand how to cross midline of my body, right? Cross one arm from the right side of my body over to the left and so on. Simple movements that my mind couldn't map to my body very well. So we have obviously come a very long way, and I owe so much to both my parents. They have been very supportive because I was not always quick. I started running the summer before high school and always had these big dreams of being really competitive later on. And, oh, I really want to make the Olympic trials, and they see these amazing athletes on TV. I want to do what they're doing. And they were like, how do we support this kid with such big dreams when he really isn't that quick? And they, to their credit, they never, ever wavered. And so much hard work and training went into this before I became any version of quick or good at running. But my first run I ever did, and this is a really good story. My parents worked with international students for the majority of their life. The Millersville International House is an off-campus dorm for students studying at Millersville University. It's okay. Just across the way from where we live. And my dad was the director of student life there. And we, whenever they had overflow or like all the rooms were full, we would host international students in our home. So I grew up amongst different cultures, which was awesome. I really, really loved that. Anyway, we had a businessman who came to study English. He came from Spain. His name was Alberto. And he was training for the New York City Marathon. I was 12 at the time. And every morning I would see him go out and run. Couple hours later, hour to 2 hours later, he'd come back. And I became pretty fascinated by this, kind of obsessed. And I asked my mom, hey, can I ask Alberto if I can go running with him? And she's like, Ryan, he's training for a marathon. No, you can't go running with him. But I'm pretty stubborn and obviously bullheaded a little bit. So I asked anyway. He didn't speak a ton of English at the time, but he was like, see, come run. Thank you so much. You know, thank you very much. See, come run. And I went out in, you know, Velcro sneakers that, gosh, they may have even lit up when I stepped on them. I really hope they didn't. And did 7 miles with him my first day. And just, I was in love afterwards. I'd never felt that good before. So that was how I began running. And then all through high school, very injured, little more health in college, but the origin to running was very humble, very slow, very injured. I was placed in an autistic support classroom, when I went to high school for the first time. And this was early 2000s. So people were just starting to learn about the needs for support for people on the spectrum, but the research was new and the training was new. And therefore there were gaps and, you know, mistakes and mishaps. So the support in that room was not there. I was told, you have a disability, don't try these things, you'll fail. Like, you're not able to do them, go back to your coloring books. And that was the message for every day for a year. And running was, whenever I was healthy, was the outlet for that, but I wasn't always healthy. So we've come a long way. And I just think it's important for anyone who is neurodiverse to know that, like, there are tough times, but You have so much strength and you have so much courage and you have so much resiliency, and that those are gifts, hugely important gifts. And just keep going, and you never know what can happen. I'm 30 now and life is looking up.
Thank you for sharing all of that. I mean, there's so much in that I want to touch in. I feel like you've just like cooked like Christmas dinner. And I'm just trying to be like, okay, can I go back to the starters before I get into the veins, you know?
Back to the food analogies. I was hoping that would come full circle.
Because it keeps coming back. But like, I think as well, because, you know, you were homeschooled before going into high school. Mm-hmm, and it was really important as well, was that you talked about the importance of your parents, because if they had all accepted that that sort of assessment by the medical professional, okay, about the verbal side and the physical side, that could have potentially been like, okay, we're not going to talk to him, we're not going to get him physically active. That could have created a different person to who you are today.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that's incredible. Like, they didn't listen to that and they didn't accept it as that kind of fact, really. And even, I don't know, probably going off topic, but like, you probably are aware, especially in this day and age, I mean, we've spoken about this before, that people may look at us and be like, you don't appear autistic, you know, like there's some sort of thing that you should be doing, like the extreme version of, you know, nonverbal, can't leave the home without a carer type thing. It's almost like people assume that you're almost faking it, you know. Can you talk a little bit about those kind of maybe experiences that you've had as well, especially, you know, now where, you know, you kind of maybe face some, a little bit of resistance almost when you talk about it?
Yeah, no, you bring up a really good point. I don't know too much about your experience with that, but for the most part, I haven't really encountered too much pushback. I think part of that could be the fact that I was pretty low functioning when I was a kid. So like, I went through those years of it being very apparent, probably way more apparent than I thought it was when I was that age. And there have been a couple running related connections of mine who like I've opened up to, and, you know, they were like, oh yeah, yeah, for sure. And then, you know, some newspaper articles come out and they talk about me being on the spectrum, and they were like, oh, I mean, we talked about it, but we were like, really, we're not 100% sure. And so I've had a little bit of a taste of it, but nothing in a bad way at all, by my opinion. But I'm glad you brought up this point, because I don't feel disabled, right? Like I will always have this diagnosis, and it'll always be an important part of who I am, because it's forced me to have to fight, and it's forced me to have more courage. And I'm grateful for the traits that have come out of it, even though there have been times that have been very challenging. But I feel like I'm in recovery, which maybe isn't the proper clinical term. But, you know, if I have a panic attack, I'm experiencing a human moment. I know neurotypical people who have panic attacks. If I'm able to have great friendships and community and we have a game night, then I'm having a human experience and really good connections. If I'm going through a low time at work and struggling to get things done, well, normal people struggle to get things done too. And I believe in myself, and I have the skills now to figure it out. Like I'm able to navigate this world. I'm able to be a participating member of society. I'm able to make an impact in the people's lives I work with. I'm hopefully able to make an impact through the running parts of my life, which would be very important to me, and it's something I want to do. Life is harder for me in some ways, and life is harder for a lot of people. And, you know, everyone has their own things that they're going through. For all of those reasons, I feel like I have this diagnosis. It's a part of me, but I'm a fully functioning member of society, and I'm recovered from the really damaging parts of it. And I think I'm grateful to be able to put it that way. And I think for anyone who is struggling with anything, just like the least we can do is provide hope, provide the ability for recovery, because without hope, there's nothing. Like, we have to provide that option, you know?
I love the way you've explained that. And I could be assuming here, so tell me if I'm wrong, but from working from being diagnosed early on, that has probably given you the opportunity, and with your parents' help, probably community, to recognize maybe certain triggers or things that may be triggering you, or, you know, and learn how to manage your autism, because everyone's autism is different. I know one of the key parts of what you're trying to do is to try to be an advocate of autism, and, you know, just talk about it, especially with some of the youth as well. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think you hit it spot on there. And I also think if you have a story of difficulty that could help somebody else feel less alone, or that somebody else could relate to, then, you know, why? I've never been an overly private person. You know, why keep that to yourself if it can benefit somebody else? So I'm doing my best to be an open book and all in for sharing my experiences in the hope that they can provide hope and benefit to somebody else who may be in a similar situation or was in the past in a similar situation. Just this past Boston buildup, I was able to work with a autism running group. I don't know if I have the proper terminology here, but a hospital or a clinic that deals with people with mental challenges called Phil Haven, that's local to where I live. And they put together a running group of people on the spectrum. And for an hour each week, they would do some walking, some jogging. And then at the end of the spring, they would run a 5K. And I got to join as a guest speaker and go on a run with these pretty cool people for one of their practices and share my story and hear theirs. And then we, you know, share some steps and some jogging together. And it was a really remarkable experience. It's the first time I've done something like that. And I hope to do many more things like that in the future. So here's to more opportunities like that, because that was lovely.
I think it's really cool to talk about just using your own challenges to help other people, because you never know who it can help and who's listening, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you never know. We never know how many lives we impact, you know, and I think it's important to keep in mind that the world would be a different place without us, you know, and to live our best life and be kind to others and, you know, try to share that positivity and that support for lack of trying to get all cheesy and sappy.
Yeah. I mean, I know what you mean. I think it's just one of those things. I think with people generally, I think if it's something close to you, then you are a better place to talk about it. And obviously you care about it more. So it's going to come across. And I think if you've got experience, sometimes I feel like, I don't know, like if you've gone through something, actually makes you sometimes, not all cases, but sometimes better place to be able to help other people go through those sort of challenges as well.
Definitely, yeah. I fully agree with that. The hard times can be turned into, there can be beauty that comes out of it. There's not always a rhyme or a reason for going through something, but I think everything's redeemable and everything can be used for good down the road.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes back to what your mum said at the start with the conversation. You can let it fuel you or we can let it fall off you. And I think that could even apply to what we're talking about now, to be honest. I think it's it's so transferable.
Yes, I agree.
So it's really been interesting talking to you about that side. And I wanted to take a gear change and just talk about how we learn through the act of failing. And now I don't mean failing in terms of like your life is over, but we all have moments where we try something, it doesn't work, but we learn a lesson through that. And I want to talk about some of your experiences. Can you talk a little bit about something that sticks out to you?
Yeah, there are a few things that come to mind. I also really appreciate the way you frame that, right? Because if we don't do what we had hoped to do, or we quote unquote fail, but we learn from it, well, then it's not really failing, right? Because we apply that knowledge and do better the next time. So the first thing that comes to mind for me is running has always been a really important aspect of my life. And when I first got into it, there were a lot of aspects of my life that didn't work. So like I clenched onto running. It's like, this is my thing. I got to make this work. This is the only thing I have that puts me on a level playing field with my peers. It's the only thing I have that, you know, for a select few that I'm better at. And I continued that clenching of running and that mindset through college, through the early post-collegiate years of trying to run. And then COVID hit. And I was injured in such a way that cycling would aggravate my knee. And running would obviously aggravate my knee. And I was also dealing with some plantar fascia issues at the time. Gyms were shut down. So like physical outlets were pretty limited. And I was in counseling at this point. And by an athlete standards, it was the first time I felt truly out of shape. It was a really hard time for me, actually. I won't sugarcoat that. That was rough. Early COVID was hard. But through counseling, I realized that I had to, you know, open my fists, open hand running, and even give it up, like just be able to grieve it. And I did mm-hmm. grieve it. And then, you know, but every now and then do some running, because I could handle like a few miles here, a few miles there without getting too banged up. And that cycle continued for a while. I was working odd jobs here and there, just trying to find what I could throughout COVID. Then after, you know, learning how to unclench my hands and release running, that then I was able to begin to enjoy it again, like go back to the root of it, how I loved it. I started playing around on trails. We have a really technical, pretty difficult trail close to where I live called the Conestoga. And I would go out there every weekend and just hammer the single track. And when I had to hike, I'd hike. When I could run, I'd run. Who cares? This is fun. I love nature. And just got back to the roots of really enjoying running. And then, let's see, 2022 Thanksgiving, I was in Virginia with my dad's side of the family. We had an Airbnb, which was a fun vacation. I didn't sleep great that night, and I was like, I need to go shake some things up. And I thought I'd go out for an easy half hour, keep it really slow. And 10 miles later, I come back having run 5:33 average for those 10 miles. And I was like, well, trails work. Trails are legitimate. And from that point, I was like, well, I'm healthier again. The trails have helped, like, bulletproof my feet and make my feet and my tendons stronger. And I got into strength training again, and then started getting serious for Boston 2023 around the new year. So I think I had to learn that, like, I can't clench this running thing out of desperation, but release it, enjoy it, love it, be thankful that I can pursue it. That was a huge learning. Other more technical ones that come to mind is I'd never gotten the fueling right for a marathon. And for Boston, I did get the fueling right. So I definitely had some pretty unpleasant last 6 miles of a marathon in my first three attempts. And Boston, I took in much more fuel, a lot more carbs, better electrolytes. And I mean, I didn't hit the wall in Boston, so that obviously worked. And that was being able to, like, learn through some unpleasant marathon experiences in the past. And then just learning that I don't have to hit, like, you know, oh, you're not a real distance runner unless you're popping out 85 to 95 mile weeks, which I've tried to do and have gotten injured. So for the Boston build, I was like, I'm going to release that. It's just a number. I'm going to run 50 mile weeks and do a lot of strength training and stay healthy and see where that gets me. And it got me to a 2:27 marathon. So I learned through the mistakes of trying to press and force fitness. And my coach has a saying that I love. He's like, getting better as slowly as possible. And I love that flip. And I'm like, yes, that is going to be me. I'm going to get better as slowly as possible, because not forcing it will allow me to be consistent, and consistency compounds. So those are the things that come to mind, but I love that question.
There's so much in that that I want to touch on. But I think the most important thing that struck out to me was just, you know, when you're pursuing running, there's a moment where it's fun when you first start off, and then you kind of have other people's opinions of what it is, and you do more research into it, and you start forming your own opinions, and then it becomes more serious. And before you know it, you're at a different place to where you started, and you're going for it, but you're not enjoying it. And I think it's really interesting to talk about that space where you had to pull back and actually rediscover the love for running. And I think those things can coincide. Like, you're not always going to be skipping and, like, clicking your heels every run. But I think this trying
not
to get
not in
that,
marathon training, no.
No, definitely not. It's definitely getting that space right between wanting to push yourself and pursue something, like, greater, but also enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. It all has to start from joy, I think, or at least any healthy version of running needs to start from a joy of the sport and a passion to pursue it. So yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
And also, I think what your coach said, I think that's, like, wise wisdom. I think everything, you know, you're trying to, like, build and force, and it's just like, you know, getting better slowly, I think is such an important thing. And I had a race today. I was doing a 10K, and, you know, not every race you're going to fly out of the blocks, you know, and crush, you know, And I, you know, I looked at it and thought, you know what, I did the best I could in the day. I'm not like too mad about it. But a really good friend of mine, Phil King, who's a fellow six-star finisher, he basically wrote on my post, he said, you know, when the grind doesn't stop, breakthroughs will happen. And it kind of reminds me of what you just said there, what your coach said, like, it's a slow burn, you know, you're just mm-hmm. staying consistent. And then people look at you and go, how did you make that amazing one workout happen? Did you not see all the years of
all the years? Yeah.
All the runs.
I actually had a race this morning too, and it was humid and hot, and oh, it just, yeah, it was one of those that was like, well, I ran that. It didn't feel great. It didn't go great. And we'll just have to get back to the process. So there's, it ebbs and flows, highs and lows.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just, I think sometimes you know it, you're pushing through it, but you just know it's one of those days, but you still give it your best effort. And you know,
that's the
best you want a day.
No, I knew from the first quarter mile, I was like, nothing about this feels race ready. Like, this is just going to be a slow grind.
That's how I felt. I completely could relate to that. I think before we kind of close off the conversation, I want to ask you, if you could go back and speak to your younger self now, what advice would you give yourself?
You're going to make it. You're going to get through. That's such a good question. Oh, I love that. Just if I could speak to teenage me, right? The teenager who was in the classroom receiving the messages that he would always fail. I would just say, you're going to make it. It's going to get less intense. The roller coaster's going to calm down. And you're like, anyone who's just feeling trapped, like there's no possible way out. Like the pain of those moments is so real and so intense and very valid, but you're going to pull through, and moments are temporary. And if you're in one of those hard moments, then you're strong because you're still fighting, and that moment will pass for forever, how long it takes it, a day, a week, a month, a season. But like it, yeah, I would say to myself that you're going to make it. And that you have worth, and that you're valued, and that you're pretty damn cool.
Oh, I love that. There's so much like gold in what you just said there. You know, even when you talked about the stuff about the moment passing, and I feel like that is, I feel that's something that we all learn through running. You know.
Oh, right. The relief at the finish line, right? It's almost instantaneous. Yes. Like you're in the deepest pain you could possibly be in, and within a minute of finishing, like the relief just comes right off.
Because you know that moment is like, even when it feels like you're suffering, like you're saying, it's going to be over in X amount of minutes, and you know, then you're going to be reminiscing about how great it was, but it didn't feel that great. But also also jokes aside, I think the self-love aspect as well, and just talking about being recognizing your value, I think, and talking yourself up, I think, is so important. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for asking.
Ryan, it's been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Hey, anytime, Marcus. I've had a blast too. I really appreciate you having me on.
Before we go, how can people follow you on social media and support the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I'm not great at social media, so that's the disclaimer. I'm only really active on Instagram and a little bit on Facebook. And my Instagram handle is flyinryan, all lowercase. And then 2028 as one of my dreams is to be able to make the Olympic marathon trials by 2028. So Flying Ryan 2028. And at the bottom of my bio, there's a link to support OAR, Organization for Autism Research for Chicago. So if anyone feels so inclined, there's a link at the bottom of my Instagram bio to take you to a place where you can support Organization for Autism Research and my race at Chicago.
All right, Ryan. Thank you for being a guest on the Runner's Life podcast.
Marcus, thank you. This was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.